Gareth Evans, how's it going, mate?
Yeah, doing okay. I mean, all things considered, we're doing all right.
You are one of the best action directors, period. When it comes to action movies, at this current time, you'd be hard pressed to find anyone better. It's amazing what you've done. But what really boggles my mind is, did you do martial arts as a kid? Where does that interest that's so prevalent in martial arts come from with you?
I wanted to I wanted to like I grew up, as a kid, not watching and not reading sort of comic books of superheroes. But I mean, I've said it a couple of times in the past, but it's like when I first saw Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon, which is probably the first time I'd ever seen martial arts in on screen.
Same here, same here.
It was a revelation, wasn't it? And it was just that thing of you feel like you're watching an actual superhero, but flesh and blood. No cape, no gimmicks, just pure physicality and what he was able to achieve. And that to me was like, he was like godlike almost,
Oh God,
and so I
and
think
mean
that,
in that film.
yeah, I know. Well,
That's quite intense and mean.
that was one of the things with Bruce, though. I think across all of his films, I know like he started playing around with the humor a little bit more in Way of the Dragon, but in terms of his character in The Big Boss and Fist of Fury and Enter the Dragon, I mean, he was mean. I mean, it was about rage and about aggression and about anger, about
Exactly.
a hunger for revenge, but then also about the not to be too cheesy on it, but like the fury inside himself. And every time he'd kill someone, you'd feel it all etched in his face. It was anguish. Yeah, sorry, I could go off on a tangent there
Yeah,
with Bruce,
we can
but
go off on Bruce. Yeah, it's unavoidable.
exactly. And so that was my first introduction to martial arts properly, as a child, and realizing, oh, this is the thing. And I think, as in most kids in the 80s growing up in the UK, especially I was in a small community, so the only thing I had access to was like, oh, there was karate lessons down the road in the sort of local gym, right? And so I went there and joined the sessions there on the weeknight, sorry. And I did it for a little while, but I was the one running around the dojo thinking he was going to be Jackie Chan trying to do flying kicks and stuff like that when we were doing sparring sessions, not realizing there's an actual form and a sort of discipline to this. So I was, not in
Yes.
a cocky way, but
You're
just in a
supposed to be
sort
learning to fight, Gareth, not entertain people.
of exactly. I wanted to do the flips and things that I'd seen Jackie Chan doing, right? So
You're not the only one. You're not the only one.
yeah, I know. But it was one of those things where, because I used to go with my brother and he would go and do the karate lessons as well, once he stopped, because my brother was more interested in football and tennis and rugby and other sort of sports, that was when I sort of stopped going then. I looked up to my brother, I followed him a lot. And so when I didn't have somebody to go with, I was quite a shy kid when I was growing up. So that shyness then was like, oh, I don't want to go into that room if I haven't got my brother with me. And so I kind of drifted out of martial arts in terms of practicing it. And then I became obviously completely obsessed with the idea of watching it. My dad was the one responsible for getting me into it in the first place because, every other Saturday would be a trip to the video shop on the way to go watch the rugby. It would be a combination of like lots of different films. Like you'd obviously go for like American sort of commercial films and, blockbusters and stuff like that. But then every now and then we would add to the pile something unusual, something unique, something different. And my dad was a big fan of cinema, so he followed world cinema a lot. I remember him raving about Nikita before I was old enough to actually sit down and watch it. So there was always like, films from other countries coming into the house. And he's the one that brought Armor of God into the house. And then that was sort of like the introduction to Jackie Chan and got me obsessed with all of that.
Way I remember it, and I'm sure it was the same for you because we're in the same country, pretty much. All the Jackie Chan films started coming out at the same time. It's like there was Van Damme, and the way my memory is terrible, but I remember Jackie Chan film coming out, and it seemed like every month there was a new one in the video stores. Am I remembering that right?
My difficulty was my video shop was sort of like we had like two small video shops in a very small sort of like town community. It's very village, not even a town, right? So for us, it was like it was, I think for me, when I realized that Armor of God existed, it was suddenly like, oh, there are all these other films with that guy in. So I can't remember it being sort of, oh, one came out and then the other came out and then the other came out. I think later on, yes. But at the start, it was almost like, oh, wow, there's like five other films that I could be watching here. What's Wheels on Meals? What's Project A? What's, you know, Police Story and stuff like that. Actually, with Police Story, I didn't know that it was a Jackie Chan film at first because my dad had rented it. And back in those days, obviously, you used to get the box of the store, not the actual box of the film, right? I was quite despondent because my dad just brought this thing. And I was like, I don't want to watch some American film about police. I want to watch Jackie Chan. And he was like, no, we're watching this tonight. And he knew what he got. Okay. You know, but he didn't tell me. He didn't let on. And then, you know, I remember popping the tape in and then it's starting up saying, you know, the Golden Harvest logo popping up. And I was like, oh my God, this is a martial arts film. This is a martial arts film. Just being, you know, that was my association with Golden Harvest. They didn't make anything else other than just martial arts films to me at that time.
That opening and, crawl at the beginning, that meant it was martial arts film time.
Yeah, it was, 100%. Yeah. And then it unfolded, and I was just, like, obsessed with it. I remember watching that shopping centre scene, because I think we probably had it on a Saturday, so we didn't have to take it back till a Monday. So that meant Sunday, I would just spend all Sunday, watch, rewind, yeah. Just that last 15, 20 minutes the entire way through.
When do you think the seed was planted in your head that you wanted to make films of that sort of nature?
That was very late in the game, to be quite honest. That was sort of like the thing with making my own martial arts films probably didn't really become an idea in my head until Maranto, to be quite honest. I just didn't think that Welsh people could go off and make martial arts films. It was not.
I didn't either.
There wasn't a precedent for it. And so, you know, other than probably like Marcus Shakeshev, who's like, you know, been, you know, the sort of the Welsh.
Well, he's another
Chan,
anomaly.
You know?
He's
exactly. I wanted to be like the European art house filmmaker type guy. That's what I thought it was going to be. That's where I thought my career was going to go, or at least try to do that. And so I was watching a lot of Japanese cinema, a lot of sort of extreme cinema, and I was kind of like veering down that path a little bit, you know, borrowing heavily from Kitano, Kim Ki-duk and stuff like that, and Miike. And really kind of thinking, oh, I'm going to hone my craft in this. Then nothing happened for a while. And then I got hired to do a documentary out in Indonesia through my wife, who had like links to this production company back in Jakarta. And we went out there and we started making this documentary. And it was like, I had been a fan of martial arts films and had watched them a ton. But then suddenly it never really occurred to me that it could really be a viable part of my life and my career. And then suddenly I'm in this other country learning a brand new martial art that I had not really properly seen before in Silat, and seeing these different styles, these different techniques, how adaptable it was and how interesting the movements were. I found like there's a certain energy and rhythm to it. It's quite circular in its movements sometimes, you know, with elbow strikes coming down low and going back high. And I just found it really visually interesting, I guess, in a way. And we met Iko through that documentary and we couldn't take our eyes off him. We just thought he had this screen presence about him.
Yes.
And so when I spent 6 months out there doing that documentary, it was kind of like a litmus test to be like, oh, can I live out here? Can I actually base myself out here and set up shop here? And I felt like I could. And so then we went back out there, and then, you know, after spending 5-6 months working for a TV company, hated my job. I ended up, you know, writing Maranto.
So obviously you've took in all this knowledge of martial arts films growing up watching them. When you thought, okay, I'm going to make a martial arts film now, like how did you figure out the best way to shoot it? Because I think instinctively you knew how to do it. Is that just from the knowledge of watching films?
Combination of things. One was just when I knew I was going to go off and make Maranto, I did three things that were key to, you know. And I look back on Maranto and I'm still like, okay, I changed this bit, I changed that bit, I shoot this differently, I cut that differently. We all do. We all look back and, you know, find the flaws or whatever in what we do. You know, we're human at the end of the day. And it's like three things that kind of like set me up ready for doing something like Maranto was that the first thing was research. I just watched all the films I remember loving back then and analyzed them and really like try to watch, see what Jackie was doing with the camera, what Samuel was doing with the camera, you know, and just learn from them and just like try to figure out why am I responding to certain types of martial arts in movies? Why am I responding to the presentation of it, in some films and not in others? What are the things that feel eggy? And why are they feeling eggy? Because I'd never analyzed it before. I'd never sort of broken it down into its elements before. And so I started, you know, picking away at those films, finding shots and movement of camera that I really liked and responded to. It was the first time I kind of realized, watching something like the ending of Heart of Dragon, for instance, it was the first time that I realized when I was watching that, because there was just something I loved about the rhythm of that sequence. It was something I loved about the way Samuel was shooting that sequence that I didn't really know what it was. And then I started realizing, you know what, there's really good contra moves here with the action. There's really good dolly shot movements in the
He moves the camera brilliantly, Samuel.
Oh, better than anyone, I'd argue, in terms of martial arts stuff. I think he's a genius, you know? So that was the first thing I did. The second thing I did was I actually shot two sort of short test fight sequences with the guys first.
All right.
The first one I did, which
you'll
was
want to see these test fights. Come on.
No, you don't.
We do. We want to know how the legend began.
Ropey at the start. So we did that, and then that was the first thing we shot. It was about 6 minutes odd, 7 minutes odd, and it was like a group fight against Ico that then ended up climaxing with Ico fighting against Yayan. And you know, this was like one of the first few times I'd met Yayan, actually, I think, on that little short thing we did.
Yeah.
And then we did another one then, which was a little bit more. Okay, let's go down into the car park of the office and shoot the fight sequence where Ico has to fight against Pat Edwell, who was the Silat Harimau instructor who did the choreography, with the guys on Marantau on the first film. And we did a little sort of like short fight there where I play around a little bit more with my camera moves. I felt a bit more confident, you know, sort of starting to get to there. And so like those two short films kind of like gave me an opportunity to try the stuff and to figure out some stuff and to scrutinize where I was going wrong. And then try to kind of fix that progressively then as we were leading up towards what would have been the feature.
Yeah.
But I was still bricking them. I was still terrified and nervous. And so that the third thing then, and this is the most important thing, and this is the thing that, you know, I've carried through all the way through everything I've done since and have never wanted to change that method, is previs. It's just like the most valuable tool I could imagine when it comes to action filmmaking. I swear by it. I'll never do it any other way than the way I've been doing it since then. And it existed back then because it was a safety net.
And did you get the idea to do previs from anywhere else, or did it just instinctively come to you as, okay, this will be a good idea?
I want to say I must have seen something online, like, you know, behind the scenes of something else being made where they might have shown
8711 became famous in Hollywood for doing these fight previs.
Yeah.
And I would see a lot of them. And until John Wick, the fight previs was always better than the final products in whatever movie they'd done it for.
Yeah.
they became quite famous for that.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, like, that would have been pre them being able to control the fate of the fight.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and which is a major thing, you know what I mean, and unless you have somebody, you know, sat in the director's seat that actually respects the fight and respects the action design,
yeah,
it can go all sorts of different ways. Then, you know, but go back to it. I mean, like, guys like Isaac, you know what I mean? Like, they, you know, he comes from a martial arts background. He understands the fight discipline. He understands the importance of shooting.
Yeah. But we never prevised it. We just rehearsed the fights.
Oh, really?
We never prevised it. No, we'd record it to remember it, so we didn't forget it. But then Isaac, on the day, would look at a section of the fight and say, okay, let's go from here to here, and I want to film it like this.
Wow.
That's how we did it with Isaac, yeah.
See, he's got that in his head that he knows exactly what he wants.
Yes.
I'm f***ing awful for that. I'm really bad at that.
You're doing it anyway, and you're doing it in the previous.
Yes,
But I suppose it's very smart to have that safety net of, okay, I'm filming it in the gym, and we're going to try some different angles out. I'm going to cut it together. And then we're going to find what it is in the gym, which I think is what you do. And then when you get onto set, you have the blueprint then, and you know exactly what to do. You're not going to waste any time.
No.
This is what we're going to do.
What we started doing now, like working with Jude on stuff, is what we've started doing, which is like, you know, to be honest, probably something I wish I'd done in Indonesia as well. It just makes much more sense. Is that we would always shoot like a sort of, like, we call it like the Tai Chi speed version first. So like when we're doing these little fight sequences, like I'll figure figure out my shots with the guys where I'm just like, oh, I'll just go like 30%, 40%. Okay. I just want to find the shot first. Because like, I don't want them to take like an accidental clatter or a bump or whatever, yeah. You know, when, when I'm still figuring out the shot, like each shot one by one, I'm like 30%, 40% speed. I don't need it any faster than that for now. Just slow it down. And then I know then, okay, if there's like a punch coming from here, how can I best represent that? What can I do with the camera? How can I how can I figure out the best way to show the audience that piece of movement there? Yeah. And it allows me to get, you know, under the hood, so to speak. It allows me to scrutinize the action then and then be able to figure
out. What Isaac would do as well, but he'd be doing it on the day. So
that's halfway the thing.
Through a fight day and he's going, show me again, show me again. Okay, one more time, show me again. And I'm like, I'm absolutely knackered. Can we just shoot it?
Amazing. So this fight sequence, Christ, I tell you what, this is such a long time ago. It's such a weird thing to kind of revisit.
Oh, he just flew over the bar.
Yeah. we were really, I remember us being really happy with
following the beer bottle. That is a lovely little shot, just following the beer bottle as it goes in.
I swear some of that stuff would have probably come from like Samo or Jackie's work. Like it's the traditional thing of like, Samo does it a lot where he has these shots where you have the hero framed and then like a knife will come into frame. Like it'll jump in from the side and it'll fill the frame with it. And it's the, oh, this is the new threat. This is the new thing that you're introducing. And I guarantee it probably came from there. You know, this whole sequence, man, we shot in this club. It was like such a sort of a small little space. It wasn't the most conducive to filmmaking. But I remember when Ico did his first sort of like low kick and high kick to the face. I remember when we did it, the take that we ended up using, he was so, so happy that we got the blocking just right. Because, you know, like with all things, you never want to actually kick someone in the face and stuff like that. So just to get that I always kept telling him, oh, make sure it feels like a snap. Make sure when you hit it, it's got like a snap. And if his timing and then the stunt performer's timing is exact, then it'll feel like a kick. It'll feel for real. I remember he was so excited and happy when we did playback on that shot in particular, because we were like, oh, it looks really good. And this would have been early in the production as well when we did that nightclub scene.
Can I just say that the bit where he throws the guy and he does half a spin and then he front kicks him across the table, we completely ripped that off for Undisputed 3.
Nice. I
agree with one of the security guards, Larnell. And I think it was my idea to rip you off, but Larnell.
There we go.
Did you think to yourself at any point, I've made a mistake giving him a blue shirt, because now as soon as the fight starts, he's going to be absolutely saturated in sweat?
Mate, the worst thing was letting him grow his hair. Was asking him to grow his hair, because it was like one of those things where Ico's hair, when it was long back then, would only look good when it was soaking wet with sweat. Because it would just dry up and just puff up. And so we were always...
Got something in common there. Now talk to me about dropping the stuff that you actually shoot into the previs as you do it, because I never heard of anyone do that until you said it. It makes perfect sense. I have not been able to do that on my movies because the dick guy is always like, I know I need time to get it.
Right.
I don't understand the technological side of things, but we can't do that.
Yeah, well, if this is always where I have to give a tip of the hat to Danu, my dit guy from Indonesia, because he set up the network system for me and spoiled me rotten in Indonesia when we did the Raid 2. And I've brought Danu over since then for everything I've done. So like he worked on Apostle, he worked on Gangs, and the system that he puts in place is brilliant, where literally, you know, his laptop is sitting there on set nearby the monitors. It's connected to a network cable or with a Wi-Fi signal. And basically, while we're shooting every shot of that action sequence, my edit is sat on there. And so when it sits on the thing there, as soon as I call cut on anything, obviously Danu's team then are sending that file across to me over a LAN network. And so by the time I'm kind of ready to sort of sit down at the laptop and try to drop that shot in, it's usually sat there on the hard drive. If not, I'm waiting like maybe 30 seconds. That's it. We always have a sort of like a joke around about the fact that we used to joke around about how quickly can you get a file to me? you know, can you get it to me before I'm stood at the laptop, you know, and all that. Like, this kind of like a back and forth. It keeps everyone on their toes a little bit, you know, in a fun way. And so, yeah, so I'll cut that in then. So while...
That must give you immediate peace of mind.
Oh, yeah. 100%. I mean,
even though you've just shot it and you know it works, but to see how it relates to the previous shot that you just did, and you have the previous anyway, so you're going to see how then it links on to the next part.
Yeah. And then also, it's like, well, that's the beauty of it, because you can see, you know, are the shots working? Because there's so many different parameters and so many variables that could change differently on a take, whether it's a slight repo of the camera that's, you know, not quite right, or whether, you know, the performance takes a little longer, or whether there's something that the actor's done which is different, but I prefer it. You know what I mean? So if there's something that's like that within the shot, then
or I might where somebody gets hit in the face and you want to keep it.
or a movement or an evasion. Let's do that. Yeah, then, okay. And basically when you get something like that just works, right? But it might not cut into the next shot, or it might need another shot to add. I know I need that shot. I know it right there in that moment. I'm not sort of like, you know, 3 days later we've left the set and be like, oh, I wish we could go back and get that insert, or can we add that to the schedule, please? You know, can we find some way of doing that insert? That's like, no, I'm good. I know exactly what I need as we're shooting it. And so I can make those decisions there and then in that moment. And yeah, it is peace of mind as well, because I can see it coming together. I can see it formulating. But also on top of that, you know, it's great for the cast and the crew, because I'm not like precious. I'm not sort of like, this is my monitor and no one's allowed to see it. Yeah. Like when I cut the stuff and then like at the end of every day, we might have like a 40, 50 second sequence then that's already put together, that's already edited together, because I've done my little frame cuts here and there, little speed ramps or whatever I need to do, just to make sure I've got it. And then I've gone through that process. So like when people are having lunch, I might, you know, quickly scoff down some food so I can just do 10, 15 minutes of tweaking and tightening on the cut. And then at the end of the day, then if anyone wants to come and look at the monitor, even though most of them want to go home, some of them will want to crowd around and just take a look at what they did that day and see it there and then and be able to be like, oh, shit, we achieved something. It. Oh, yeah, totally. It's a real morale boost.
It's very hard, isn't it, making fights? Physically very taxing, you know.
Yeah.
It gets to a point where you're just like, can this just be over and done with? And do you really need another take? Can we just live with that one? Mm-hmm. But I guess if you're seeing that and it's really working, then you get very energized by that. Well, the thing, most people fall into the trap of shooting action the Hollywood way. I mean, if you went to Hollywood school, they would say, shoot the master, shoot the coverage, we'll edit it all together.
No.
I mean, how did you know to not do it that way? It's just an instinctive thing. Because I have to say this, to be honest, I used to make my own little home movies when I was a kid, knowing nothing about filmmaking or how they did it. Mm. And I instinctively did it the Hong Kong way, because that's just what made sense. I'm going to shoot this bit. Oh, yeah. And then there's an edit there. So then we'll get this angle and then we'll get this angle. So was it the thing?
I think so. I think because I knew I was going to edit the thing myself, there's that weird internal logic then, which tells you where you would put your cuts.
Mm.
And so I never ever entertained the idea that we would do any kind of masters for anything in terms of fight sequences. You know what I mean? To this day, I hate shooting wide masters of drama scenes, even, you know, never mind action sequences. I hate wasting, you know, the time that you spend on going through two or three takes or something on a massive wide, when really I know already in my head kind of how I want that scene to play out and how I want to kind of cut to it, where the emotion is. So I hate doing those wide masters. Everyone keeps saying, like, oh, don't you think you're going to need it? And they are right. I do end up needing it from, like, you know, from an editorial standpoint.
Beginning,
like,
of it and the end.
In and out of. Yeah, the beginning and the very end. Yeah. But that's the thing. And it's like, you know, so when it came to action, it was almost like, no, I don't need this. Because there's no one shot that's going to sustain you for the entire sequence.
I mean, if it's acting, it's a good idea to maybe warm up the performers, do a nice wide, you know, take, if you forget your lines, keep going. Let's all understand what the scene is. But if it's action, you got to conserve people's energy.
Exactly. Exactly. But it just helps. I think it really helps. I think performers prefer shooting like that, I think, as opposed to doing the long takes of, got it or not.
For me, it's insanely frustrating knowing that I'm doing a load of stuff that's going to end up on the editing room floor. And for me to be doing a movie where I know it's all been shot wrong, mm-hmm. very frustrating. And if it's a film that I'm starring in, I won't let that happen. I mean, I have done it in the past a little bit, not now, but if it's a bigger movie, I've probably got a smaller role and I just have to bite my lip and go, this is going to. So this is a really interesting shot.
Yeah, this was, I always knew I wanted this shot. We spent a while getting this one in because it was, and this is probably like the first time I played with the idea of, you know, knowing that I could rotate the camera quite so smoothly. Because, you know, I came from background of doing, like before this, I'd only done super low budget independent stuff. And so suddenly it's like, oh, wait, there's a, it was that thing of like the idea of like the jib was sort of, was quite complicated, and the fact that it allowed that kind of camera movement, it was my first experience of doing that. So when it comes to some of the older stuff I've done, you know, some of that stuff like with Maranto, I was very naive. I was very new to the process. So I remember, you know, jumping onto that shoot thinking, oh, we'll blitz through this. It'll be really quick. It'll be just like when I did like Footsteps, which was, you know, five members of crew. So when we did Maranto, suddenly it's like 100 plus people. And I really was so green and so naive throughout that entire process. I mean, I used to go up to Matt all the time and be like, oh, can you get me this angle, please? And then, you know, he'd go up and then sort that out. And then I'd be looking at the camera to kind of make a mental note of what the lens number was. Like, oh, so, okay, so that's an 85. Okay, oh, this is 65, yeah. Oh, this is a 50 or a 35. And then I'd try to remember that for the next day. Because, you know, I guarantee it. Like, I probably looked super, super inexperienced with the crew. You know, had an ambition that I wanted to achieve with the film, but no real experience of doing a film of this scale before. So it was a real learning curve, this one was. It was brutal, but yeah.
How did you do that shot? Was it one of these fig rig things? Or you said it was a jib?
That one wasn't a fig. I'm pretty sure that was on a jimmy jib. It was sort of like, I wanted it to feel like the sort of, you know, when you get those body cam shots where they're attached to the actor.
Because that's what I thought it was at first. And I was like, sure.
But that was the thing. The challenge was to kind of rise with him at the same time, but then but not for it to feel like a gimmick, you know, not for it to, because I'll be honest, sometimes when I see the body cam stuff or like a POV shot in an action sequence, I always find it draws too much attention to itself as a gimmick, as a setup. And so when we did that shot of Eco getting up off the floor, I didn't want something that would take the audience out. So I knew I wanted to glide up with him and feel like we're anchored to him, but there's enough flexibility there and enough sort of like, you know, waviness in there so that when we do detach from him, you're sort of back in to your traditional narrative where you're filming it then. This shot here, when he jumps over, this one there.
Lovely.
That the start of that one coming over with him, we were trying to rip off the shot from one of the Bourne films. Like it wasn't Supremacy or Ultimatum. Oh, Supremacy, I think it was. Through the window. Yeah. Obviously, but we couldn't follow that far because we didn't have the sort of the same kind of rig. So we had a crane that just went as far as it could go over the edge before we had to sort of call cut on, or, you know, cut in the shot then.
Yeah, well, that bit born, one of the stuntmen jumps off the roof with him. He was on a wire.
That's right. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, how did that shot with the guy falling off? I mean, it's a great directorial touch there. The guy, he hits him with a stick and then he falls down and hits the floor. How did you do that?
The gag with the pole going through his chest.
Yeah.
So I remember we knew that we would get so far with that shot. So we had the guy on a wire. We had a pullback system so that he would jump so far and then get sort of pulled back. So it would like mimic the idea of him being like hit with something. So yeah. Eco had like a big sort of bamboo with a massive soft noodle rubber thing on the end of it, you know? So it was like one of those, like it would have just like folded and everything else, you know? So he was kind of coming towards him with that and then hitting him with that thing. And then it would be like at the moment of impact, they would yank him back. So it would be boom and then like this. And then when we did the one following down with him, we literally set up two cranes then, and we had Matt, I think Matt did it or maybe Dimas did it, where he was kind of on a wire as well. We suspended the two actors, there's a stunt performer and then Dimas, and then we had them in tandem drop down to the sort of the ground below, which is obviously a load of boxes with a fake floor and rubber and everything else for the guy to land on. And so, you know, probably, I think we probably would have done quite a lot of sort of like speed ramping in the fall, because there was just no way to kind of get that done in camera, or for obvious reasons. Because it wasn't just about dropping a guy onto boxes or something. It was
what did he land on?
Because it looks like one shot he hits the floor.
Yeah, he's landing on, I think it's like boxes and a rubber mat or something like that. And then we just dusted it and then put some fake rubble down.
Like a concrete floor.
Yeah, no. I don't think it was a concrete floor. Right. So he hits that then. And basically, yeah, we just did that. We just did a whole thing. It was a very controlled thing. It was like a pulley system because we needed them to be both in sync with each other. And that was the hard part, was getting them to both go and then and land at the same time.
Marantau, compared to the Raid, what stands out to me in the way you shoot in the fights, it's got a similar feel, handheld. Mm. By the time you went to do the Raid, the handheld became even more prevalent. So we've got the Bourne sort of shaky cam stuff where you can't see anything of what's going on, but it's like you've took that sort of template of the erratic handheld, very kinetic feel, but you're doing it in a way that we can see everything that needs to be seen.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of shutter speed that you're playing with as well?
I think so. I think Matt would be the best person to kind of answer that one. When we think we did shoot a higher shutter speed for make sure we had, you know, the detail and it'd be tight, you know, more crisp in terms of the focus and stuff, and more sharp following the movement of the action. So we wouldn't smear across the screen because we knew we'd have a bit more movement. I think the main difference between why Marantau and why the Raid feel so different in terms of that energy level is because when we were doing Marantau, we weren't shooting on sort of like proper what you'd expect cameras for film, for making a feature film of that nature. We were shooting on the big broadcast cameras of the old P2 card stuff, right? Which was like the Panasonic P2.
Cameras.
It was like the shoulder rig ones that you'd get for like broadcast. You know, for news anchors and stuff like that, you know, that kind of thing, not for running around with an action thing. We were sticking that thing on a Steadicam. And, you know, we did a lot of Steadicam on Marantau. That's why it kind of floats and glides. And that's why, to be honest, when I watch it now, it's like some of that stuff, like especially that fight done by the bamboo scaffolding. That one, Marantau specifically, for the first 2/3 of the film, is more influenced by Jackie's work. So like those fights, that fight with the little construction site with the bamboo scaffolding, it's playful, it's knockabout, and it's like, oh, we're going to show you this loop of rope because that's going to get used now, and we're going to feed a hand through it, and we're going to tighten him up and tie him to that. You know, there's going to be a little thing that gets thrown into the face. He's going to get scooped up and bounce off the wheelbarrow. And that wheelbarrow gag was something that we ripped wholesale off from Police Story 2. So there's the scene in Police Story 2 when he rushes in, pop, 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 punches the guy, and the guy's body hits a wheelbarrow on the way down to the ground. And I was like, oh, we should do that. We should definitely do that. And so it's more playful. And then as the film progresses and as the tone of the story gets more serious, so does the action. It becomes more brutal and more violent than in Marantau. I got to give a shout out to Mike Leader, because when he saw Marantau, he was like, there was loads to admire to it. But he was like, I think you might be burning your actors out by doing too many long takes on Steadicam. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think you're right, because we, you know, so the guys were exhausted.
Isaac about that as well.
Yeah, hook him up. And so when it came to the Raid, then not only was I, you know, mindful of what Mike had told me in terms of that idea of like breaking the action down into like slightly smaller pieces and then being more specific with it, but I had been watching religiously this music video by Roman Gavras, Born Free, the MIA song Born Free. There's an amazing music video, but it's all about sort of like, you know, a SWAT team rounding up a bunch of kids with ginger hair and stuff like that and all that, it's like talking about race relations and stuff like that in America. And basically when I watched that music video, it's got tons of energy going on, and it's like, it's breakneck, the pace is fast, but it's got this like semi-documentary style feel to it, where you're bundling along over the shoulders of these SWAT team members. And I just remember saying to Matt, this is the feel of the Raid. This is what we should be trying to achieve with the Raid. We should be with them over their shoulder. And then as everything kicks off, we stay in their perspective. We stay anchored with them as much as possible. And so it lent itself to a thing where I felt like if we're going to shoot the drama in this way of them storming that building and going in floor by floor, and then, you know, we're going to have that sort of discipline in terms of how we're going to shoot the drama elements, then if the action suddenly becomes smooth, steady cam shots that are just curving around beautifully choreographed action, it won't match up. It'll be tonally two different things. And I knew this would be a bit more grubby and a bit more grimy. And it just felt like, you know what? I think the way we shoot action should reflect that. It should be a continuation of a style so that it doesn't feel like you've got two different films sandwiched together. And so that lent itself to a slightly more handheld style, but also what allowed us to go handheld, because obviously if we were still using those big broadcast cameras, we'd have no chance of doing that. But Panasonic had released the new camera then, which is the AF100. We were still in the early days of Red back then, so we weren't, the Red Scarlet was being talked about, but hadn't yet come out when we did the Raid 1. If it had come out, we would have shot with the Red Scarlet, because that was the one we had eyes on. That's, we were like,
smaller version of the Red, is it?
Smaller, slightly smaller version than the Red, yeah. Still heavy, but like smaller and more compact. Yeah. And so back then it was anyway. And so, you know, we were like, right, we wanted to use the AF100 because it was the best thing that we could at that time for that kind of compactness. And so we did a Frankenstein's monster of that camera, where we recorded out onto external recording to get 422 color. And then we had all the bells and whistles on it. And then basically what we started using on that film was the Fig Rig. Yeah, which Mike Figgis invented for Time Code, I think, because he just wanted his DPs. He had a four DV cameras recording at once, and he didn't want it to all feel like literally handheld, you know, in the palm of the hand. And then it allowed them the flexibility to shoot using these steering wheel rigs. And
allowed you to do crazy stuff like going through the floor, like turning it like this in a fight, turning it like this.
You've got grip handles all over the place then. So you can grip hold of it. You can pass it from one DP to another DP. Yeah. You can come down really low from the ground and then swing up and be high within all the time it takes you to lift your arms. So it allowed you to reset quite a lot throughout the space then. And for us, it was a revelation.
So mostly using quite a wide lens. So you're quite close to the action or...
Oh, yeah, quite often. I mean, like, unless we're doing a specific insert where we want that detail, then we'll swing up to a tighter lens, like a 35 maybe or something. But 9 times out of 10, we're hovering between 12 and 20. You know, we're never really going like, you know, we don't go wider than 12 because it just starts getting cartoonish and everyone starts stretching at the sides. But 12 to 14 is kind of our go-to. All right, so this fight... This is another example of being stuck inside the small sort of like corridor space and having to sort of, yeah, here you go. Look, see, we're in line with the door. That was what I was talking about earlier. So in that shot in particular, we were literally in line with the door in order to get the width of that shot. We knew with this fight scene, I mean, we wanted to feel breakneck and sort of crazy place. That was one of those Dutch tilts that we did with the camera as well. I was talking earlier about body cam stuff and POV stuff, right? And we did have a plan on one of the shots there. You know when the guy leaps towards him and jumps on him and they crash to the floor?
Yeah.
We did at that point sort of have an idea in mind of having a body camera attached to the back of him and to follow him on that leap.
Right.
But Matt Flannery, who's always right with these things, was like, dude, don't do that. It's too gimmicky. It's going to break you out of there and it's going to feel forced. Let's just try to follow him and have that handheld feel over his shoulder. You know, I think I can get that. I think I can, if I jump off an Apple box, I'll follow him on the jump. And he was right. He was totally right because the gimmick didn't really work then.
You seem to punctuate fights with extreme moments of violence.
Yeah. So we cheesily referred to them as punchlines when we're designing the fight scenes, where I feel like every fight should kind of, every good fight should have like 4 or 5 good punchlines, like good moments within the choreography where you get the audience to do a collective gasp or something, you know? And one of the things I've learned doing this stuff and you know, Christ, feels like such a lifetime ago now, watching films in the cinema with people is the communal aspect of a fight sequence when it plays out. When one of those punchlines lands and it lands hard, the audience get a real kick out of it because it creates a weird sense of levity within the scene. So that when you see something so outrageous, and the other thing I'd say is that when we do hit you with these pockets of like strong violence, they're not prolonged. So that, you know, it's like you get a glimpse of something, you get like a little bit of detail, enough to kind of like to fill that part of your brain with it. And then we whip and cut away and we go show you something else now. And then the next build up to what the next punchline will be further down the line. And it's just so much fun to kind of like to do those sequences and to kind of like to hear the audience sort of like erupt into laughter, because they realize that, you know, if you're sat in a room of 200, 300 people, and then at the exact same moment, all of you have gone like that,
yeah,
it suddenly becomes absurd and it becomes funny and it becomes silly. And you can kind of like enjoy the moment of it then. So that when the fight is over, the idea is that you've taken them on that journey where the adrenaline is kicking up and up and up and up throughout the entire fight sequence. That by the end of it, when it settles, and like quite a lot of the fights I do sort of end the same way, where it's like it suddenly goes quiet, you know. So you're in this high energy, high stakes sequence, and then it just zoom, it drops. So in that moment, that's when you get those moments where the audience and are all hearing each other kind of catch their breath, and then they realize, oh, we've just been on this roller coaster ride.
Just breaks out laughing because
yeah,
you don't know
yeah.
what else to do. It's shocking.
Obviously, when we're shooting martial arts, the one thing that I'm fully aware of, and it's one of the hardest things to kind of for me to wrap my head around, is the fact that when you shoot it, it's piece by piece, it's shot by shot. And I'm guessing, like, cause like you're not doing sort of like, you know, long coverage of the entire sequence from one angle. I mean, I guess your experience has been similar to what we do as well, which is jigsaw pieces of the fight sequence unfolding. Right.
Yeah.
And when you do that, the one thing I've always kind of found interesting and fascinating is how you guys as performers maintain a sense of understanding of where your head is at during that fight. Because, you know, each fight tells a story. Every fight has a little bit of a journey and the characters go on those journeys too. And so, you know, it's that idea of like, whether it's purely down to like showing the idea of, okay, this is where I'm more fatigued, or this is a part of the fight where I'm desperately trying to get the upper hand, or, you know, all of those things, is because what people don't realize when they just watch martial arts films is that all of those things are shot over, like, you know, consecutive days in sometimes 5 to 10 second chunks. And so to have that sort of like that flow, that through flow of continuity in terms of a performance that takes you from the beginning of the fight to the end of the fight, it's a challenge. And so, like, what goes on in your head then when you're doing scenes like that?
I think you've got to make those decisions in the rehearsal process and just try not to forget it on the day.
Yeah.
You know, make mental notes. Oh, this is the bit where I want to, or maybe I've got an idea for a line that I might want to say here, or this is like where the axis tilts in the fight and I get the upper hand. Yeah. And to just remember to be tired as well, because we are tired all the time.
Yeah.
Because you're doing it so much. But, you know, as soon as they say action, you know, you go into it and you do it. You definitely need to make a mental note of, no, normal, real people can't fight for this long without getting tired. So that's something I try to do these days, which I probably didn't do in the past. But then again, it depends on the tone of the movie.
Yeah.
But I think you just got to make that decision in the rehearsal process and just try not to forget when you're absolutely shattered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not like you've got a script of the fight, is it?
Yeah.
It's kind of in your head.
Well, yeah, it's all part of the design process, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah. Was it Jackie Chan said something like, making action films is much harder because you've got to do all the action and then you've got to act.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So... There are some directors that come along and they shoot something in a certain way that's so impactful that it then becomes that you have to copy what that director has done. So when I think of John Woo, it's like everyone did the two guns in the slow motion and the doves. Maybe not the doves, but, you know, they tried to John Woo it up. And then Michael Mann came along with Heat and he did what he did. And it was like, okay, that's the way to shoot a gunfight now. Make it real. Make the bullets sound like they're actually going through buildings. Chad Stahelski with John Wick. You know, people want to copy that style. When you came out with The Raid and the way you shot the fights, people want to copy that style because it was just something that, you know, we kind of seen it all before, but it was new enough that it was something different. The way you're moving the camera, it's got a lot in common with Saving Private Ryan, from as far as I could tell. It seems like it's a higher shutter speed. It's a very dynamic camera. But what's most important and where a lot of people go wrong is you can always see the action and you always understand the geography of the set and where everyone is and where the kicks are coming from. And it's not over edited.
It's nice to kind of hear that about the fact that it's still got clarity, because quite often you see people might be like, I remember somebody criticizing The Raid 2 saying, oh, there's too much shaky cam, da da da, framing's all off. No. And then it's like, and I'm like, you know, there's clarity there. Like, there's energy to them. I agree, there's energy to the shots, you know what I mean? And I think that's the difference of it, because there's a certain style of like chaos cinema where it's just, it's crazy. It's like 15 cuts in like every sort of like 3 or 4 seconds and it's all close ups. You're not really seeing the detail. Yeah. I think what we try to do at least is maintain that sense of geographical space so that you're not lost in the movement of something. You're not sort of trying to figure out, where am I in the room right now? You always want to know exactly where you are, and you know where the attacks are coming from. You know how, well, the relationship of that action is with the space that you're in. And so I've always felt like, yeah, we definitely bring energy there, but I would sort of like, that's the thing I might counter, would be that it's not purely like shaky cam represents a style of filmmaking that's probably different from what I'm aiming for, if that makes sense, because I want you to follow it. I want you to see the detail of it. This shot here, by the way, I'm pretty sure we did quite a long take with Baseball Batman. I gotta remind myself of this, hold on. Yeah, because there's three people there, yeah. So I remember when we shot this, like, Very, by the way, who plays Baseball Batman, he is amazing. Like, he was a member of Eco's...
that kills me, that one, on the top of it.
Well, I'll give credit, that was referencing Violent Cop, the Takeshi Kitano film. There's an amazing bit in there where, like, a slow-mo sequence, and the guy just gets, bong, hit on the top of the head. And it always went through me. Like, I'm quite squeamish in real life, weirdly.
How can you be squeamish? Look at what we've got.
Yeah, I know, but this is...
You're a sick man.
But this is just condoms of fake blood. You know what I mean? We did loads of practical effects in this thing. Like, every time you see the blood spilling, it's a condom that's being strapped to that person's body with where we kind of, like, we took all the sort of lubricant off it so they were dry, filled them with blood. Stuck some tape on with super glue, and then we'd attach that to the weapons. So then on those shots, if we knew we'd go like in, and then I knew my cut point was her pulling out the hammer. Right. So then when in the next shot, then we'd have the hammer with a little bit of string attached to the condom with the tape on it. And then 3, 2, 1, pull. And then the timing would be perfect. You just get this explosion of like fake blood going everywhere. That one
is always the best.
Yeah. I mean, like, when you got time, it works perfectly. The problem we got nowadays is that we feel like we have so little time to kind of execute these things that do we really want to do the practical? Could we not do the CG version? It's like, yeah, the CG version can look good.
Bitch, when you've got to clean up the blood,
it's a nightmare, isn't it? And I think what we tend to do now is we will do a couple of takes of the clean version without any practical effects to make sure that we've got the shot. And then we do a take with the practical effects, and we do one more take with the actual practical effects. So that if we, you know, by that time, like the first few takes, you've ironed out the creases of, oh, that shot didn't go right, or the timing was off, or the reaction wasn't right. And then you got the reaction right then on a clean version. And then the next one is like, let's replicate that, but now with actual practical effects. And then, you know, you get the best of both worlds. And if the shot works well on the practical, great. If not, you've got reference for the VFX to use, which is in camera. This was a very, very, very cold field in Kent in December. I still haven't fully got the feeling back in two of my toes. It was just ice cold there. It was unreal. You know, mud up to our shins and stuff like that. It was insane. But yeah, we did some, you know, this was like one of those experiences.
Hard-boiled.
Yeah, very much. Shot. Yeah, 100%. Like, we knew we wanted a scrambler bike, and then Ray Nick then with the shotgun as well, and Joel on the bike. And we did like some, we did some pretty intensive stuff here. Dave Judge was our guy for the rigging, so he did all sort of the wire work with the bungee onto Joel, who got yanked off the back of the bike, and then about to pop out through this window is Andy Taylor, who's like part of our stunt team as well. He was part of the design aspect of it. He also did the guy burning with the petrol bomb as well when in the middle of the thing. I mean, like, me and Jude and the team, when we were designing this sequence, like, we, you know, it's that weird thing of being in a, we were in an aircraft hangar, or no, we were in the studio. We booked the studio out at Three Mills. So we could build like the cardboard boxes of the caravans and get a rough sense of placement and positioning, in order to do the previs again, in order to figure out exactly how we were going to shoot this thing. And it was a pretty ambitious shoot.
A phenomenal job, the whole of Gangs of London. I've never seen action of that quality in any TV series ever. I've never seen action of that quality close to ever. It is absolutely incredible. And I just want to say to people, if anyone wants to learn how to shoot, how to film a gunfight, for my money, that is the way to do it. There is something to be said about seeing the gun shoot and whatever is getting hit, get hit in the same shot. And it is the same process as filming a fight. You want to see the guy throw the punch and the other guy get hit by the punch in one shot. And when you can do that, like you do, or John Woo does, that's the gravy. That's what makes it great.
No, I agree completely. It's like, because I hated the idea of doing, like, my least favorite shots across anything that we do is when it's like, oh, it's a guy shooting a gun past camera and then another shot of somebody else reacting to it. I hate those moments. Like, they bother me more. You need them, of course you do. Best. But that's the thing. It's like, it's when you see, like, for me, it's like when we're in the loft in episode 5 and Mal is going crazy and he has his little heroic bloodshed moment and he's like shooting the hell out of Andy and then dives around the corner and shoots Craig in the legs and stuff, and then they drop and face each other. And then they're like shooting at each other from point blank range and stuff.
That's
like that.
Amazing.
It all just feels more visceral. It feels more real, and it's just got a ton of energy. And it's the same way that we would do from like martial arts then as well. But it's like, but with gunplay. And I think those are my favorite moments within them because it's just more immediate then, I think.
Yeah, it's the same concept, isn't it? It works for gunfights and for fights. Just cause and effect in the same shot. That's where it's at.
100%.
Yeah. Gareth Evans, thank you so much, mate. It's a pleasure talking to you. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it so much. It's been such fun to kind of like just chat about it, you know, and obviously I even know I've been a fan of your work as well and stuff like that. So it's like, it's always exciting to see. Like for me, it's like, it's always a process of just learning from other people, what other people are doing too, you know. You learn from each other. It's like a shared community of figuring out what works and what doesn't work. So it's like, you know, when you guys are putting films out, when George Miller did like Mad Max or Fury Road and stuff like that, and with the guys that were doing John Wick with Chad and David as well, when we're all kind of like pushing to try and find what the next cool thing is or the next sort of like the next thing that's going to be like, oh man, that was incredible. Like we're all watching each other's stuff. We're all sort of learning from each other and all kind of like analyzing each other's work. So I just feel like it's a great community and a great sort of like opportunity to keep pushing the discipline and keep pushing it as an art form. I think, you know, like we were talking earlier with the stunts thing, it's something you feel like should get rewarded at some point. I feel like the fact that there's no stunt coordinator award at the Oscars is insane. Because the level of professionalism that needs to go into these things is astounding. So I just love being able to be in a situation now where I get to talk to people like yourselves, I get to talk to and learn from other people and take that on board and put it into my own work as well. So it's a great old experience, isn't it? Wouldn't want to do anything else.
Thanks for giving us some of your time, mate, to educate us about the art of action.